Bob Hoy, editor and chief investment strategist of Institutional Advisors. Welcome back.
Good to be with you, Chris, and also with your listeners. We have an absolutely gorgeous day in Vancouver. Sunshine, snow on the ground, still freezing. Vancouver doesn't often get snow. This is the banana belt of Canada, you know.
Yes, it is. And that I presume that would be due to the warm weather that, of course, circulates from the southern hemisphere.
On the coast, so you get the moderating effect of the ocean.
Canada is regularly, the people are voted the nicest people in the world.
Yeah, no, a lot of that is self-promoted out of Ontario, who is solidly liberal. And they just think they're absolutely wonderful. The sun is streaming into my office. I got the curtains closed and it's warm.
Oh, it's wonderful. And you know, nothing better for you, especially in the wintertime. Keeps the circadian rhythm right. It shakes off the seasonal affective disorder blues. It massively increases your vitamin D production.
I'll tell you a secret about how old-time Vancouverites judge the weather. You look at the mountains, and if you can see the mountains... you know it's going to rain. If you can't see the mountains, you know it is raining.
After over 15 years of NAFTA sending our jobs, we've hemorrhaged something to the tune of, I want to get this right, close to 6 million industrial jobs. It's several thousand plants. Industrial plants have shut down. Here we have this one individual who is now threatening CEOs, if you take your plants and your manufacturing overseas, you can do so, but how about a 30 to 35% tax on you if you do it?
That's tailored to be attractive to the Democrat labor side. But he's going to accomplish the same thing with lower taxes and lower regulations anyway.
I really believe here that this is more far-reaching statement. The shot heard around the economic globe. We're not going to let you gut our nation anymore, multinationals. If you want to do business here, you're going to have to look out for the domestic population first. That is absolutely, I think, the most profound thing that any politician has done since at least the mid-80s.
I appreciate that because in being a financial historian, it also makes you a political historian. And my thesis has been that there has been three great experiments in authoritarian government in the senior economy over the last 2,000 years. And you determine this by just reading the history, but also in looking at the price history of consumer prices. And the 3rd century in Rome had prices went up by about 40 times as the government turned authoritarian, price and wage controls backed up by the sword. And then eventually the public threw it off. Then the next time there was 100 years of similar price inflation was in the 1500s, and it ran into the early 1600s. And it was the same thing, only that one, the ambitious bureaucracy. There was only one organization for the bureaucracy to corrupt, and that was the Catholic Church. And it became, it became bloodthirsty as well. But the folks took a look at it and said, this is not right. A family man in business, raising kids and doing business was good. The church became predatory, and it was thrown off in the early 1600s. Then the next period following the early 1600s is, they've called it, you know, small L liberalism, like the real thing, sovereignty of the individual and limited government. So then somehow, beginning around 1900, the world went off into another century of authoritarian government and all of the excesses. And this is now our case is that this is culminating, so within all of this, even going back to ancient Egypt, you've had popular uprisings, and it was always about a restlessness amongst the local people and government being living well while the locals were not living well. And then they would have there's an explanation then for dynastic changes in ancient Egypt. The public would show off the governing classes. And then you move forward to in Europe in the medieval period, there would be peasant riots. And then in the late 1500s, there was one that a historian described as it was a typical peasant riot turned into an iconoclastic rebellion against and the Spanish government in the Spanish Netherlands. So here we are, a restless public, looking at the incredible excesses of unlimited government, even within Canada and the United States, beginning to do something about it. So this is a piece, published it on July 4th, Independence Day, called The American Spring, and then looked back at the Prague Spring of 1968, which was a strong attempt, but then the authoritarian government quelled it. Then more recently you had the Arab Spring, and the authoritarian quelled that one. So we asked the question, would the American Spring be successful? And I purposely used rural term. And this step by Trump, it should be put in perspective. The movement is a popular uprising. It happened to choose Trump as the leader, and he will be bound by this popular uprising. And I think most of what he will do will be within the approval of this popular uprising. Now that he's very colorful, he may be offensive to some people's sense of good taste, but he won't be offensive to good order, and other than extremely upset liberals out there and Democrats who are, just have had the greatest shock in the history of expanding authoritarian government within the United States. So here it's, and so then with the election, published a piece called "Draining the Swamp." And this will happen. It is the same thing as in the early 1600s when individuals, the Reformation is better to be followed in England rather than in Europe, because Europe had turned nasty with the 30 Years' War, whereas in England, the transition did suffer the Civil War in 1642, but essentially it was bloodless. So it took a number of attempts to end an extremely authoritarian government. And one of them involved in the early 1600s, a long boom had come to an end, and also a war had come to an end, so there was unemployment and hardship. So the government in England felt compelled to do something, so they came up with an absolutely preposterous idea. There's no need to explain what it is, but the merchants in London looked at it and condemned it. They said, this is just absolute nonsense. And then you had the crash that began in 1618, and it was proved to be nonsense, and it was very expensive. The crown suffered a huge loss. And at the time, these practical merchants looked at the plan and called it tyrannical duncery. Like in today's terms, it would be tyrannical stupidity, where somebody with authority has got a whim to do something and is going to do it. Is that the really big example of tyrannical duncery is the notion that a committee of bureaucrats can manage the temperature or the climate of the planet. I mean, this one is so preposterous, you can't believe it. Ancient past, even priesthoods, merely set themselves up to intervene with the gods, and they never, ever really would claim to be God.
We're not getting into a political minefield here, but what is, I think, hopefully can resonate with the typical American listener, because we have such a global audience here, but with the American listener is, it is quintessentially American for the pendulum to swing back. It has been overwhelmingly swung to the one side for at least 24 consecutive years, and I would argue that's the globalist and elitist side. And now the shot heard around the world, interestingly, occurred first with Brexit, I think, and you could argue maybe with Grexit.
Yeah, that was June.
Yeah, Grexit, then Brexit. And let's not forget the next topic du jour that I'd love for us to discuss, and that's the Itsit, if I'm saying it correctly, the Italy exit.
You rang the bell with Brexit. Looking at an authoritarian government in Brussels that was not just authoritarian, it was remote. So then let's go back to the United States in 1775, 1776, when the issue was not just an authoritarian government, but a remote government because it was in England. And at that time, unfortunately, the British crown was and ran it too hard. This is similar. The American Revolution was what I call a benefit, as nasty as it was with warfare, but it was a beneficial revolution because it was run by merchants, smallholders, farmers, tenants, mechanics, the whole thing. Whereas with the French Revolution later, 1797, we were in different cultural circumstances, and the popular dissatisfaction was taken over by what I call neurotic intellectuals, and it went into a reign of terror. So then the other big revolution was the Russian Revolution, 1917. It was taken over by neurotic intellectuals and became a reign of terror. So the best example of a revolution is in England in 1688 called the Glorious Revolution, and it was peaceable. And it was run by merchants, let's put this back up now, Protestant merchants out of London and Protestants through the rest of the country. King James was Catholic, and in order to impose his authority, he even talked about bringing over troops from France. Now, that was a big no-no. So anyways, it was a very successful revolution and won by the guys, and that then completed Great Britain's reform from absolutist monarchy to a parliamentarian system. So the intellectuals have been in control. They created a distorted Federal Reserve in order to do it. And then as if managing the economy wasn't enough to do, they then had on the challenge of managing the temperature of the planet. I mean, this stuff is so absurd that a few years from now, people are going to look back on it and say, well, how did it ever happen? But it happened because constitutional limits were bypassed. And also, that would be in more or less political activity or the excesses of government, but also is funded by an extremely reckless central bank. And again, a non-convertible currency is unconstitutional. So the Americans have had a very paranoid written constitution that was designed to prevent exactly what's been going on for the last 20 years. And in England, you don't have a written constitution, but you have a long tradition of legislation and statute and law that normally would have prevented such an experiment. But as I said, it brewed up in 1900. It's run ever since. And there's only been two other examples in the last 2,000 years. And what is really exciting, Chris, is that this thing is ending. And the other thing is you got the weather, the climate cooperating. You now have the El Nino drove temperatures up sharply into 2015 and through most of 2016. On the air temperature satellite determined over the land, the last few months have recorded the sharpest decline in that temperature reading since you've had satellite temperatures, 28 years ago. I mean, this is very sharp. So the way to look at it is that the El Nino is a weather event. Now, then the other major climate event through the 1940s, 50s, 60s, 70s, you had a solar maximum that was the most busy period for the sun in thousands of years. And then with that, you had, I still think, and you look at any number of charts on it, that if you take temperature history in 25-year segments, that the 25 years focused on, this, say, the 1930s, so you go 1930s into the 1940s, was the warmest period, and it still is by a number of measures. You got to understand that the climate promotion industry is desperate to have their theory about carbon dioxide proved. So they have actually been lowering temperatures from 20, 25 years ago, maintain an uptrend, and they threw in a lot of garbage stuff from ocean temperatures. But if you take the satellite record, as this El Nino disappears and a La Nina comes in, it'll be back to the flatlining temperatures of the previous 18 or 19 years. And this then is most distressful to the establishment, which has been promoting hysteria. So here we have a political reform going on, which is natural because of the excesses of the governing classes. At the same time, the solar system has arranged to bring in an end to a few hundred years of rising temperatures. Well, more than a few hundred, say the Little Ice Age reached its coldest in the late 1600s, and it's been warming on that basis ever since. And now the solar physicists who forecast in the 1990s, they forecast the turn to a solar minimum, they've been right. This solar minimum is likely to continue for a number of years, and it's already back to the lows of early 1900s, and some solar physicists feel that this could even go so far as to back to something similar to the Maunder minimum, whereby in the late 1600s, the solar activity, well, there were no sunspots at all. So for an old retired geophysicist like me, this climate side is very exciting.
I just finished this fascinating book by Emmanuel Dermot, a physicist as well as a self-made quant, and he's actually considered one of the fathers of modern financial quantitative analysis. In the book, he discusses how when he was in school, and it was mostly Ivy League schools, he, of course, born and raised in South Africa and emigrated to the United States, how they had an interesting box. People by the thousands would send into the Ivy League schools all these theories and theorems and concepts, and he concentrated mostly on this crackpot box. And it dawned on him, that's what I'm more interested in. And the key takeaway point, you know, there's something like 250,000 theorems that are proved each year around the world. Of course, it would be impossible for anyone to wrap their minds, even read that many papers and comprehend all of these new theorems, mathematical, that are postulated. The people who got the reins, who grabbed control of the Western society for the last 20, 30 years, the Keynesians, hardcore Keynesians, their work deserves to be in that box. It's brilliant, it's well thought out, but it doesn't work in reality.
What I've used on that one is that Keynesian economics of the central bank adjusting interest rates to help the business cycle, and then the state coming in with expenditures or stopping expenditures, has been a great theory. But you can, it's I've explained it as the equivalent. The comparison would be from Euclidean geometry, which describes the real world, straight lines, parallel lines, angles, that sort of stuff. Then you have non-Euclidean geometry, where you start with some other assumption.
I would argue that non-Euclidean geometry is the real geometry. The Platonic geometry and the Aristotelian are actually fallacious, and here's why. There's this very interesting man who I just finished the second reading of his biography, and we've all heard of the Riemann hypothesis and, of course, the Zeta function. Math was combined with physics. It was one and the same. So he created this non-Euclidean geometry, which we now know today as Riemannian manifolds, this little-known patent patent clerk in Switzerland picked up on the idea of Riemannian geometry and incorporated it into his general relativity, and that is where he got his curved space-time concept, latest shot heard around the world by Italian voters on Sunday evening. They voted no. Now we had the Grexit, we had the Brexit, and then we had the Trumpsit, I guess, and now we have the Italian banks are counting on their EU confederates to help keep the system afloat. What does this mean for Italy, the euro, the eurozone, and the United States?
The yields in Europe, the 10-year notes from Germany to England to Italy to Portugal, had been rising in anticipation of this. I guess the latest focus was the Italian vote. And then they backed off in the last few days. But interest rates in Europe are now rising trend, the 10-year note. And in the U.S., of course, the yields reversed in early July to rising. That's the long end. And then also you had LIBOR start to a really strong advance as well. So that has to do, well, when we made the call on the long bond in early July, we never bothered putting a reason on why long rates would go up. It was just that the technicals were so strong for a reversal. Now, looking back at it, what has happened is there was a wave of positiveness came through, and so you had the U.S. third quarter GDP number, although it's as phony as it was, better, and that's to the end of September, so it was before Trump. So things have been positive here, and interest rates going up is based with that. But overall, Chris, this is another great reformation following another great experiment in authoritarian government. Now, with the Reformation in the 1600s, because religion was such a dominant part of life then, it's been described as the Protestant Reformation. And I like to explain to people, take out the capital from capital P, Protestant, just say protest. Or take out the capital N from a nonconformist. Just so this was the ordinary citizen looking at the governing classes living very well and intruding on the life of ordinary people. The church in the end of the 1600s found more reasons you could think of in order to confiscate money. Many different rules and regulations, and then the other way that they were able to get even at small merchants was to declare priest day, saints days, and church holidays. They were up to something like 125 in a year, and workers would take the day off. So here again, the imposition of the state, that then was a combination of state and church. Now here what you have with what the movement in the United States faced with this election was that you had a combination of big government, IRS, Justice Department, FBI, combined with the media, which is supposed to be independent and critical, as in Fourth Estate, all combined with the Democrat Party. So this was a powerful movement that there's no doubt in my mind that it was aiming to set up a one-party system. And you've had the shock of all shocks. The electorate became galvanized enough.
Here we have an actual leader who's being vilified by the media, rightly or wrongly, to put an end to the tyranny of the dollar. And of course, we're not anti-dollar here. They're talking about capital controls in Turkey. And then we move over a little bit further to India.
I look at it as ending action for their experience with authoritarian government. This is so you have to have the government doing something that is so bizarre that the public says, hey, you're out of here. And this is what happened in the U.S. The whole apparatus of the movement, Democrats and media and Department of Justice and everything else just became so bizarre. And the more bizarre they became, the more the ordinary person got pissed off and said, you're out of here. I'm going to vote. And so the point, I think the term I've been using, ending action, really is appropriate. It's like anything in the markets where it's in short supply and the bulls get more and more aggressive as it goes up. You got the shorts trying a little short and then forced to cover, so you have short covering buying going on as it peaks. So this movement in politics is like a huge short squeeze, where in this case, the shorts are the old movement that has gone to ending action, and here's the result. So I'd expect, and I have a friend who is a mining analyst. He's very good, Jayant. We should make the introductions. He's originally from East India. His piece last week had a very good comment on it. So, but I don't know that he's calling for ending action. He's just, at the moment, describing it as absolutely outrageous. But the history side suggests that it is ending action, and you will see a reform movement begin to become effective in India at some time. I mean, not being there, you can't. I'm not in a position to say when, but I can tell you the focal point of the U.S. win on the election is the defining moment, the defining event. And I've also written that it is irrevocable. There is no taking it back. This one is just so profound. So it's sort of like when you were with Eastern Europeans in the late 80s, where they looked at the governing classes, the nomenclature, the apparatchiks, and said, you guys are living well, your promises are bogus, and we're not living so well. And they took on a murderous police state in Eastern Germany and Poland and Russia, and they shut it down. And they ran the risk of, and here's where the interesting part is, that the authoritarians in, let's say, East Germany or Poland talked about sending in the tanks like they did in Czechoslovakia in 1968. But there seems to be, Chris, a moment in time where the imposition of authority is 24 hours a day, 7 days a week of hammering with the fist. And then the other half of the equation are those who are subjected to authoritarian, and they have a complacency to go along with it. And then there's an instant in time where those on top lose the will to impose authority, and those below look and realize, hey, this is the change. That was the case. Now, do you know the date that they brought down the Berlin Wall was November the 9th, 1989. Now, the date that the results of the election were realized in the United States was November the 9th. Sort of interesting date.
It leads to massive global hyperinflation that will ultimately collapse the entire system.
What you have here is, let's look at the control of information. In the last Reformation in England, you were in a period where the state and church had virtual control over the media. They could only ones that could afford to pay the scribes to write the books. Sure, printing was coming along, but folks didn't have much money to buy the books. But by the time you got to the early 1600s, there was prosperity of the middle class were growing, and the cost of publishing was diminishing. So, but the state was very used to control. They also had, in the case of England, through the Anglican Church, they also had the pulpits. What they called news books were being published with the stories, books, accounts, information that the middle classes wanted. So that's when Archbishop Laud was head of the infamous Star Chamber. And if you didn't shape up according to the dictates of the Star Chamber, if you were a prosperous businessman with stature, but they weren't going so far as to state murder. That was for exceptional cases. the uprising classes in England had their news books published in Amsterdam, which was free, and shipped over and then distributed. So the point is that even with immense control over the media, the uprising bypassed it, and this is where, in this case with the U.S. election, Trump and his tweets and the whole media, so you were able to get around the mainstream media and defeat them. And they will be continue to be defeated. So then, now that's the political side.
The IRS has just ruled that they can go through your blockchain and check for transactions in order to prove whether or not you have been paying taxes. Again, I'm a huge proponent of cryptocurrencies. I've actually created my own humble silver bit, just based on silver dimes. They're going to regulate every single thing they can until we're down to a fully digital economy. And then anyone who dares to use gold and silver coins and things that will be vilified, I believe Prime Minister Modi has actually said publicly, we will tax every single transaction.
Yeah, Chris, that was the political change. Now, this is where the public take over their government from the experts, prove that you can have a self-governing country. And these threats on money side and everything else, those are projecting the past into the future. And the next step will be, as the public is taking control of their government, they will also define their own money, and it will be a plain, simple currency with a gold standard, gold convertibility. Because, as I said, on the previous experiments in authoritarian government, they were funded through confiscatory taxation, which the public threw off, and they were also funded by massive depreciation of the currency, which the public ended. So the two things go together, the intrusion and the currency depreciation, and I would expect the similar thing to happen, that the public are taking control of their government, and they will also define what money is. And these threats, as we're seeing in India now, which could be implied to North America, that is ending action. This, we're in the most exciting times for finance and for politics since the last Reformation began in the early 1600s. So I'm highly confident that, one, the ability of the public to take over government will happen. And also the other thing is the public will define money, and that will happen. The worst thing that can happen for a bureaucrat is where they fear the public. We're going out of the system whereby the public lived in fear of the government. When you're talking about Modi's doing and what they may do in the United States to money, that's fear, and this is what will be ending.
I think you're really paraphrasing that of one of the founders. That is, when the people fear the government, there is tyranny. When the government fears the people, there is freedom. We certainly see some signs of it. And I think just at the nascent portion of this potential populist movement, it could be quashed from the globalist movement. Suddenly, economic conditions have deteriorated to a point to where they recognize their machinations can no longer prop up the entire doomed edifice. Would it not be the perfect time to drop that on the populist movement and allow them to think they voted their heroes into power, whereas in reality, they're planning to drop the entire thing on them?
The success has already happened in an uprising with the fall of the Berlin Wall. At the time when the uprising was underway, before it got so successful as to take down the wall, if you're reading National Review, they were trying to write that this was some sort of a skullduggery thing done by the Soviet government. At the time, I was saying, look, it's just like what happened in ancient Egypt. The folks got fed up. Now, in ancient Egypt, the governing classes were protected in the palace by the palace guards with their spears. And then as the researcher on it back then in the 1970s, Barbara Gray, pointed out that at one point the palace guards were of the people, not of the governing classes, and they laid down their spears. Then you had anarchy, which meant, now in, I was expecting that in the late 80s in Eastern Europe. The palace guards were not palace guards, they were border guards, and they had AK-47s. And then in one day, they laid down their weapons and allowed the people to go cross-border shopping. And at that point, Honecker, the dictator in East Germany, had to change the law that insisted that he then execute Germans who wanted to go from one part of Germany to another. So the your atomic or your nuclear bomb is going off, but it's going off against the authoritarians. It was fascinating to me that where Eastern Europe suffered a great or enjoyed a great reform in 89, that through Obama, you then had a rush in authoritarianism such that in the senior economy, it came right out to the end of the 100-plus years of authoritarian experiment. And and you could say that the fall of the Berlin Wall was the first leg of reform in Eastern Europe. And then under Putin, you've had a counter-reformation move, whereas the main move, authoritarianism, as experienced in the United States, has run right up to recent and is enjoying the changes. So I see this as being very similar to the end of the last experiment in authoritarian government into the early 1600s. The same struggles, and I hope, and I fully expect that as it continues this reform, it will not in Canada, the United States, or England go to bloodshed. It is going to be extremely nasty because those who have had the power are going to be like 3-year-olds in a tantrum, but with weapons. But they won't use the weapons. The power of the people on this kind of a movement, as I said, in two previous examples, particularly the last one, last one meaning the early 1600s, they took on formidable powers. The state could confiscate, just accusing you of heresy, they could confiscate your property. Then if you didn't shape up, you had an interview with the Department of Inquisition. Then if you didn't shape up on that one, they burned you at the stake. Uh-uh. We won't see any of that this time around because it's a very powerful, as Victor Hugo said, there's nothing more powerful than an idea whose time has come, and this is where we are now. So, yes, you are concerned, and I'm concerned about what's going on in India, but it'd be best to look at it as ending action and whereby in the United States, the authoritarian movement may want to do what India is doing. So fascinating.
It is, and I like your idea that eventually the people will establish a gold-backed currency. Of course, the implications of this idea are maybe more profound than we have the time to delve into today. In order to back trillions of dollars, the yellow metal would require either suddenly a gold-making machine, a manufacturing machine, or a significant repricing higher of the yellow metal.
It depends on the faith and credit of the new administration when it will go to a gold standard. And all it has to do is meet obligations. Like you're going to go in today and take out a dollar's worth of gold, you can get it. But U.S. going back to a gold standard can be done very efficiently. The market will know at what price. A simple letter of instruction from the president. He is getting advice from a high-up guy on the restoration of a gold standard. Yeah, well, we've been advising institutions for a long time on interest rates, credit spreads, yield curve, commodity prices, business cycle stuff. And we can be reached at institutionaladvisors.com, or if you just Google my name, BOBHOYE, it all comes up anyway. So, and we would welcome people to look at our website. We've got the whole track record in there.
Well, we welcome Bob Hoy to return to the show with more topicality in 2017.
Very good. Okay, Chris, next time.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank. And founding director, their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice. We'll be right back.